Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is The Snow Queen. Michael Cunningham is the author of By Nightfall, Specimen Days, The Hours. Your website doesn't include something called Golden States, which is included on Wikipedia. What's that?
Oh, Golden States was my very first novel. I wrote it in about 3 weeks because I was about to turn 30, which at 29 can seem like a big deal, and at my advanced age, of course, seems like nothing at all. And I just kind of cranked it out because I vowed that I would be finished with a novel by the time I turned 30. And it's an okay book. It's done no visible harm in the world, but it's not such a great book either. And I just sort of let it go. When it comes up, I don't deny its existence, but I would rather anybody who reads novels spend that time reading something else.
It sounds like it's one of those early novels that often remains in a drawer, and it's very important for a writer's development, but not so important for a reader's development.
You know, it's funny, being a writer with a sort of semi-invisible book, Jeanette Winterson has a book we don't know about published. Doctorow has a novel he just sort of disavowed and let go. You're spending your whole life learning how to write a novel by writing novels.
But that does raise a question because you also teach writing. There's an emphasis these days on that first novel selling and suddenly they promote the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after, say, a short story collection, which is usually how it starts. And what I found is that most of the best writers I know, their first novel is far from their best novel.
Yeah. That is a truly unfortunate development in publishing. There was another time, not that long ago, when a publisher would buy your first novel, but what they were really doing was buying your next novel. They were encouraging you by publishing this. Okay, William Faulkner's novel, can you name it? First novel, can you name it? Soldier's Pay. No one reads it. But somebody published it so that he could write The Sound and the Fury and et cetera. And that is a genuinely deleterious development for writers. And I think for readers, very few writers hit it right out of the box. And many writers need the sort of encouragement and belief implied by the publication of a first novel that is a sort of early journeyman effort.
Well, what I've noticed is a lot of times it's the third or fourth novel where they really hit their stride. And the way it works in publishing these days is that by the third or fourth novel, if you haven't hit it, you're suddenly mid-list on the way down.
Yeah. The publishing business is in a difficult place right now. Not, I hasten to add, because publishers are evil corporate grubs. It's because it's hard to sell books. It's hard to stay in business. And as someone who publishes books, you really can't afford to publish too many books that don't sell at least enough copies to make back your investment. I promise you, well, I haven't met every editor, but very few editors are sitting in conference rooms thinking, how can we make life more terrible for novelists and increase our huge profit margins? Movie people are doing that, but not publishing people.
Michael Cunningham, let's talk about your latest novel, The Snow Queen. It takes place between 2004 and 2008. In Bushwick, Brooklyn, and a little bit in Williamsburg and over in the Lower East Side in New York, and concerns two brothers and their extended family, let's call it, and concerns one of the brothers, a gay brother named Barrett, his brother's name is Tyler, who has a kind of vision right outside of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the Rambles. That kind of propels it. So let's go back a little. What is the origin of this? I mean, was it you seeing a vision, investigating the idea of death? What prompted you?
You know, it's always a little hard to look back and try to remember where any novel came from. I think this one really started out as two different impulses for two different books that then sort of joined themselves. I have not seen a light in the sky, but I was raised Catholic, spent the rest of my life trying to recover. And so I do have a certain idea about divine messages. No one has chosen to deliver one to me. Part of what was interesting to me about what happens to Barrett is he's a this character. He's a regular, secular, citizen, job holder, series of bad affairs. And he not only sees a light in the sky one day, but he understands that the light sees him and then vanishes. And part of what was interesting about that to me is where Catholics are concerned, if some divinity wants to speak to you, it usually takes the form of a giant Christmas ornament that appears in the room and tells you what to do. What if you were, A, completely without any religiosity, and B, unmistakably received a sign of some larger power, but it gave you no message at all? You know, the other aspect, the brother Tyler is, well, frankly, loosely based on a couple of people I know. They will remain nameless, but if they kept their relationship to drugs a secret, I wouldn't mention them at all. I know a couple of people who have been doing quote-unquote serious drugs for quite some time, and knowing them has made me aware of the fact that we pretty much only hear one story about drugs, which is moralistic, which is shaming, and which is simplistic, which is essentially the big finger wag. You are weak and foolish and in escape from reality. Don't do this. I know from personal experience, secondhand experience, that there are more stories than that. There's always more stories than one story. People have complicated relationships to mind-altering substances. What about Cocteau? What about Carlos Castaneda? And really, I think the sort of initiating impulse for that was my desire to think about a character who does do more drugs than are technically good for him, but is trying to use them as a portal, is trying to use them to increase his awareness and his ability. He's not just some idiot doomed to die in an alley with a needle in his arm.
But he also needs to keep it secret because he knows those around him are going to look at it somewhat differently.
You know, there are very, very few people in the world who say, "Oh, honey, keep doing heroin. We're so proud of you."
There's several other things going on in The Snow Queen, Michael Cunningham, one of which is that Tyler's wife is dying of cancer.
Yeah.
The other question, which is broader, is that once again, in a Michael Cunningham novel, we have three main characters who are intertwined.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The character who has cancer is also based on someone I know. I mean, I think I wouldn't have had the temerity as a novelist to decide to write about a figure so potentially sort of sentimental and icky as a young woman with advanced cancer, unless, of course, you know somebody like that. Unless, of course, you are privy to the actual experience of being that person. Unless you are not Charles Dickens writing about Little Nell, but you are able to write about that experience from direct contact with somebody who's...
Does that mean that a lot of Barrett's and Tyler's reactions to her are the reactions of the friends surrounding your ill friend?
Yeah. You know, as a novelist, I don't work verbatim. But at the same time, I don't make things up out of whole cloth either. I know what I know about how people tend to act by seeing how people tend to act.
It takes place, starts in 2004 on the verge of Bush's second term and ends on the verge of the election of Barack Obama. What prompted you to set it during that particular period?
You know, some of these choices that you make are intentional, and some of them are slightly intuitive, and it just felt right that this book span the eve of the re-election of George W. Bush and the eve of the election of Barack Obama, and I don't think this is a spoiler, the book ends before the characters know that Barack Obama is going to be elected. There was something about sort of stringing the novel between what for me was one of the more shocking moments in American history. I'm sure some listeners will disagree, but the idea that by a small and debatable minority, the American people had actually lived through 4 years of the worst president in history and lined up and said, let's have another 4 years of a destroyed economy and wars on innocent countries. If that sounds good to me, let's just keep giving the country to the 0.001% of the rich. I'm for that. And the years between that moment and the moment at which, although the results have been not exactly what some of us have expected, but the moment when Americans elected an African-American man of intelligence and possessed of a moral sense felt like a really interesting period of time.
The other aspect of setting it then is there's a tendency years later to forget how we were actually feeling at a particular time.
Sure.
So when Tyler says point blank, tomorrow we'll wake up with Vice President Palin, and won't that be interesting? The country will never elect a black president.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what
yeah.
we were all thinking.
Yeah. One of the little jokes in the novel is that Tyler is by far the most politically adamant character. He's the one who, if he doesn't watch himself, will spoil every dinner party with a long harangue about politics. And he's wrong both times. He insists that the country would never reelect George Bush. And then years later, he insists the country will never elect a black man as president.
Michael Cunningham, you give Barrett and Liz, who is a close friend of Barrett, Tyler, and Beth, you give them a store which sells peculiar items at very, very high prices.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you know anybody who has a store like that?
Yes, yes, yes. The store is directly based on a little shop in Provincetown on Cape Cod, where I spend the summers. A very close friend of mine has this great little store, and again, as a writer, you use whatever the world shows you, and I really know very well this woman's relationship to the objects that she sells. She believes in every single one of them. She sells not one item cynically or because she thinks people will buy it. I wouldn't say that retail is an art form, but I wouldn't say it's insignificant either. And I told my friend as I was working on this that for her, one of my hopes was to write the first great American retail novel.
There's these wonderful little moments. There's a moment where Barrett is busy folding shirts, even though all the shirts are already folded. He needs something to do. The novel is filled with these kinds of moments. He goes through bad affairs, as you said, but from personal experience, particularly gay men, I don't know what that is, have gone through exactly the same affairs that Barrett has gone through.
Yeah. I mean, I bet we could get 100 women to call in to say, don't leave women out of the 100 bad affairs list.
These affairs are all somebody doesn't call and things like that.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine the other day was going to get married and was broken up by email.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, see, Barrett broken up by text.
The title, The Snow Queen, comes from Hans Christian Andersen. It's also been the title of other novels, including a science fiction novel from the late 70s. Why did you go in that direction?
This, again, was slightly intuitive. This title came to me before the first sentence did. It is a reference to the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, but it's and it contains elements of the fairy tale, but it's not really some kind of postmodern reworking of the fairy tale. I was every bit as much as drawn to the words snow, a word for drugs that I think we don't use much anymore, and queen, and Snow Queen, the Hans Christian Andersen story, and I have promised my publisher that anyone who storms back into a bookstore with this book in hand saying, I bought this book and it's not the Hans Christian Andersen story, I will repay that person. I do think that it's true to the spirit of the Hans Christian Andersen story, which, by the way, is a fairly obscure one. I would be more reluctant to call a novel Cinderella. or Goldilocks.
Well, Frozen apparently comes from that now, too.
Frozen comes from that now, too. That's pure coincidence. I had no idea that the Disney people were doing Snow Queen. But it seemed to matter somewhat that it would be, I think, difficult to walk out and stop the first 10 people you meet and say, quick, tell me the plot of the Snow Queen.
You're listening to an interview with Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is The Snow Queen. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. There's also a subtext regarding notions of success and of what actual talent is, particularly in terms of Tyler's music. Does that come from musicians? Does it come from your own feelings as a writer?
Yeah, I think more than anything, one of the reasons I chose to set the novel in this particular period, it wasn't just the idea of bracketing it with these two impossible elections. It's also set among what I think could arguably be called the first downwardly mobile generation. The first, and these people are in their late 30s, their early 40s. The story has not been told at that age, but nor are you 22 with everything ahead of you and impossible imaginings which seem perfectly plausible. These people are members of, as far as I can tell, the first generation in quite some time, certainly in America, that generally are less prosperous and less successful than their parents.
Michael Cunningham, when you're working on this, how organized is a novel like this one? And then, compare that to, say, the organization of a short story.
I really, really write short stories. As far as a novel is concerned, I wouldn't say that I approach it with no sense of organization of any kind, but I don't know where it's headed. I found that for me, and I'm sure you've talked to other writers who've said exactly the opposite, but for me, I find that if I know where a novel is going, the characters tend to become employees of the novel whose job it is to convey it to that destination, and I am always trying to write a novel that's a little bit smarter than I am, which means admitting into the process the possibility of surprise. For me. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think Flannery O'Connor, God bless her, she's had so many good quotes. One of the things she said was, how can there be any surprises for the reader if there haven't been any for the writer?
What does that mean exactly? I mean, how does that work for you?
It means, I think, exactly this. It means that as a species, we are not quite smart enough to write novels, not from the little squirrel cages of our conscious brains. That part of what a good novel, I think, almost inevitably is a marriage of your intentions and your intuitions, and that if you are too plotted and planned, your limitations are going to be apparent in the finished book.
What about the idea that your characters take over? I know that I've talked to so many different writers and gotten so many different answers.
You know, there feels like something a little wishful and romantic to me in the phrase, your characters take over. I would say that in the course, certainly of writing the first draft, your characters slowly reveal themselves. Your characters become more and more like themselves, which includes contradictions as well as confluences. I feel like you are trying to find your way toward a character who feels full and complete and human, which is slightly different from the what feels like slightly magical thinking, like, oh, the characters just take over.
What about if a character seems to veer too much to be toward whoever Michael Cunningham is?
It's funny. On one hand, I've never written a character who is me. But on the other hand, if I can't get to the point with a character at which that person feels at least somewhat autobiographical, I shouldn't be writing that person.
So you need to keep that distance at all times.
Well, you could say you need to keep that distance. You could also say you need to find that closeness. You need to find that level of empathy that allows you to feel like you are not a woman who runs a little shop and has affairs with younger men. You are not a lizard-like person from another planet, and yet if you cannot imagine your way into that person, if you cannot get to the point where you begin to feel what it's like to be that person really isn't yours to write about.
That sounds a lot like acting.
Oh, it's a lot like acting. I have some actor friends, and yeah. What they tell me about the process sounds very familiar. Like you sort of gradually find a way to inhabit the character, and the methods range from the mental to the physical. You try to imagine what it's like, how that person walks.
Michael Cunningham. I went to IMDb. You worked on a teleplay for one episode of Masters of Sex on Showtime?
I did. It was great fun.
How'd that come about?
Masters of Sex was well underway, you know, almost inevitably with a television show. There's a head writer and then a staff of, three, four, five, maybe even six writers, and they're a team. They meet way before filming starts, and they kind of plan the arc of the story together. The head writer is the leader, but the head writer is usually not the dictator. It was episode 7. They just kind of hit a snag, as a novelist does, when you just can't quite figure out how to make certain things happen. And they thought, well, what if for this one episode we just brought somebody else in and see what he might do?
What kind of research did you have to do? I mean, it's coming to a point where characters, their story arcs are all continuing, and it's leading toward hopefully something.
Sure. You know, the tricky thing with that was I had the previous episodes. Only one had been filmed. There were full scripts for the next two, and there were just sort of outlines for the subsequent episodes that led to mine. So I kind of had to pick up the threads. I had to figure out who these people were, what was about to happen to them in my episode. And I worked very closely with Michelle Ashford, who is the head writer, an incredibly gifted woman on Masters of Sex. I got some of the characters and their dialogue right, and I got some of it not right. Some of it didn't really match the way it turned out those characters were going to speak. And Michelle kept some of my lines and rewrote some of the lines.
And that's fairly normal, I would think, when someone hands in a teleplay and then it has to go through a showrunner and then to the actors. I mean, there's got to be continuity.
Oh, yeah. That's TV. And with a novel, every single line is your own. If you agree to write an episode or more for a television show, you should understand that your full hour of dialogue is not going to be filmed exactly as you wrote it.
Which brings up the question about your screenplays for Home at the End of the World and Evening. In those cases, I know that Evening you took over from Susan Minot and added whatever is Michael Cunningham to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes to a director and an editor. As the final person, quote unquote, working on the screenplay, what do you see in the final result in terms of your words, not in terms of the product?
Sure. Susan Minot is a remarkable writer, and Evening is a remarkable book. And I found that in adapting it, I kept changing it, partly because movies are a very different medium. They move very differently. Although I am proud of all the work all those incredibly gifted people did on that movie, it was a bit of a lesson. I don't really expect at any time in the future to take a novel I respect as much as I respect Susan's and adapt it. I think I would, if I get another such offer, I will ask them to call somebody else.
You know, you said before that when I asked you, I mentioned short stories, and you said you don't write them, which is kind of interesting for me because most writers who take so much care with their prose also write short stories.
Though, you know, it's funny. I don't know why this should be, but it does seem that most of the writers I know seem to tend either to write short stories or to write novels. You know, Alice Munro and William Trevor essentially write short stories. Don DeLillo essentially writes novels. Philip Roth, for as many years now, has really just written novels. I think it's something to do with the way your mind works. Do you think in 15-page arcs, or do you think in 350-page arcs?
Do you ever reach a point on when you're writing something and you go, this is the end, and you're not halfway there? Does that ever happen?
Well, I can certainly say with this new book, The Snow Queen, I thought that I had a great deal farther to go, and I reached a point at which I thought, oh, no, maybe we leave them here. Maybe we've gotten to the point. You know, fortunately, I had more like 300 pages than 70 pages. That does happen. That does happen. The ending has a way sometimes of arriving before you expected it.
Well, when that happens, do you ever feel the need to fill in the gaps to make it longer, or do you kind of go,
no,
I can't do that?
No. I mean, I think every work of fiction, from a short story to a novel, ought to be exactly as long as it needs to be. And the trick is figuring out what that is. There are novels that should be 150 pages, and there are novels that really need to be 1,000 pages.
Well, you mentioned before that they had hit a snag on Masters of Sex. Was there any snags in The Snow Queen you had to get past?
Oh, you always have to get past snags. I've always found that, it's funny, with every single novel, I get to a certain point, arbitrary number, but it tends to be around page 70 or 80, i.e. the point at which the book is in progress, the point at which the story has begun to show itself, when it just falls apart completely. I just look at it and think, this is nothing. This is not about anything. I don't know anything about these people. I don't care about these people. And when I was much younger, I would start over. I'd say, okay, now I'm going to write the novel, the snag-free novel. Now I'm going to write the novel I know how to write. And around about page 70 or 80, it would happen again. And I finally realized that what's really happening there is, at about that point, the novel is outgrowing whatever little idea led you into it and becoming itself, becoming something a little, or maybe even a lot, different from the novel you thought you were writing.
And that allows you to go on then?
Oh, yeah. It's painful, but I think it's a really good sign that the novel is taking on a life of its own, that it's not the little thing you planned, it's something else.
That sort of happens to Tyler in writing that song for Beth in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The same
yeah.
thing.
You work with what you know.
How conscious is that? I mean, I talk to some writers and they go, yeah, I know the themes. And I talk to others and they go, oh, themes? That's your job.
For me, it's a little bit of both. There are things that I know are there. I know they're there because I've put them there. And at the same time, after I finish a novel, if I'm talking to people about it and they say, well, I noticed this theme, I tend to go, oh, really? But the thing is, these people are not always, but they're often right. That, as I said earlier, I don't think a good novel is ever entirely planned. I think some of it is intuitive. Some of it just felt right. And I think certain people who read the book after you wrote it are seeing things that you put in unconsciously. That's why there are academics. That's why there are critics, though I don't read them. That's why there are readers. It's the job of the novelist to write the novel, and it's the job of other people to see more in the novel than the novelist may have seen.
Well, it's also true that the reader, no matter who the reader is, on some level is writing the novel as well because they're viewing it through their eyes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is one of the things that I do love about fiction as a medium. I think maybe to a greater degree than any other artistic medium I can think of, first the writer writes the book, and then the reader writes the book. No two readers have read the same book.
No one reader reading it, say, 10 years ago has read the same book either.
That drives me crazy, because not only are there more books than you can possibly read, you really have to read every book over at least every 10 years, because now you're a different person and you're reading a different book.
How important is surprise and spoilers, then?
Well, I think surprise is enormously important. I think every quote-unquote serious book, which is a discouraging word, but you know what I mean, is essentially a mystery. In that, in a mystery, if it's any good, the killer turns out to be somebody who was right there in front of you all along, and the adroit writer of the mystery diverted your attention in such a way that the identity of the killer is a surprise. But if it's just some psycho killer who hasn't been in the book at all, it's no good. And I think to some degree, any novelist is doing some version of that. You are sort of planting events, planting complications, and drawing the reader's attention away from them so that when certain revelations occur, they are both surprising and yet don't feel arbitrary. You ideally want the reader to think, oh, why didn't I see that?
Once you see them, they become inevitable. They had to be there, but you never saw them before.
Exactly, exactly.
Which is pretty hard to do as a writer if you're trying to function consciously, because most of this stuff has to happen on an unconscious level. So as you said at the beginning of the interview, you're surprised.
Yeah. Yes, it's hard to do. And one of the reasons you put a novel through many drafts is you try to look from draft to draft at what's there, what you want more of, what you want less of. It is hard to do. When you go to the employment agency and sign up as a novelist, if anyone tells you, oh, this is going to be easy, you should really try another agency.
I've talked to writers who say it's kind of this constant series of puzzles. How are you going to get from point A to point B? Okay, we do that, and then point B to point C, and then, oh, my God, I backed myself into a corner. Now what?
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, the answer to now what is often these last 30 pages were a mistake. My intuitions were wrong, or I didn't listen to my intuitions, and I forced these people to do something that they wouldn't do, and I have written them and myself into a blind alley, and sometimes a rather shocking number of pages have to go away.
And that's happened, I guess, with Snow Queen and with all of your novels.
You know, for me, that's simply part of the deal. I owe a third of my income to the government, and I owe about a third of my pages to the wastebasket.
And it's sometimes painful.
You know, it is painful, and yet it's inevitable. And I have to say that in a certain way, yes, it's painful, but there's also, you know that feeling you can get sometimes when you get rid of old clothes? In a funny way, almost as good as getting new clothes. It's like, done, gone. There can be a little bit of that, too.
When I'm editing, sometimes there's, you know, I'm listening to an interview and there's something really good and I'm going, and I just pull it out and suddenly the interview flows better.
Yes. Yeah, I think the two processes are probably very similar that way. You have to be ruthless with yourself. You have to be willing to dump that beautiful passage that doesn't belong.
Michael Cunningham, a couple of questions. The first is, you mentioned mysteries. Have you ever thought of writing a genre book?
Two novels ago, a novel called Specimen Days is essentially written in three different genres. There's a ghost story, a thriller, and a science fiction story. And, you know, if anything, trying to do that increased the respect that I had already for how very difficult it is to write effectively in a genre. You know, because I wasn't doing some kind of POMO take on those genres. I wanted to deliver, and I understand it's hard to do.
Are you working on something now?
I'm done. I have a book of fairy tales coming out next year, and I'm about 100 pages into a new novel.
That's pretty fast for you, then.
Oh, I work pretty steadily, and one of the things I've learned, maybe the only universal truth about publishing a novel, is that it is imperative when a novel comes out to have something else underway. So that the novel that's published feels like, oh, yeah, that, but really I'm into this.
You're way past Snow Queen at this point. That's a child who's sent out into the world.
Yeah, well, I hope I feel a healthy sense of semi-detachment from it. Of course I still care about it, but I'm thinking about something else now.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Cunningham, whose latest novel is The Snow Queen. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.